Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Vincent Emanuele. He's a writer, radio host, and community organizer. He's currently opening a cultural center called PARC, Park, Political Art Roots Culture, in Michigan City, Indiana, where he lives. So as always, thank you for your work and thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me back again.
So today I would like to talk about the relationship between martial arts training and social change, and also the possible relationship between, it seems to me also that when people have had combat experience, they end up being different sorts of activists quite often. And I don't know if that's your experience, but is that enough for you to start with, or do you want me to ask more specifically?
No, we can go straight into it from there. I mean, I think you're very correct in saying that people who have had combat experience or have been through war probably do approach activism in a different way. And I would say particularly veterans, and I would say specifically because on some level for a lot of kids growing up in America, you know, you grow up with this sense that we're the greatest country in the world. And of course, to us and to probably 99% of your listeners, that's going to sound very silly because they already know that's not the case and all the rest. But the fact of the matter is, for a lot of American children, that is the case, especially for young American boys indoctrinated with this hyper-masculinity in this patriarchal culture and growing up, you know, fantasizing about shooting weapons and shooting guns and all the rest. And I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with, say, weapons in and of themselves. And we could get to that. But, you know, and in fact, I think it's really important for activists and for just people in general, but particularly people of color and I would say women, to learn how to defend themselves on many different levels. And we could also get into that. But the growing up with this glamorization of warfare, this growing up with this in a hyper patriotic culture, and growing up in this context of American nationalism, a lot of people go into the military thinking they're going to do great things and that they're going to kill the bad guys and stand up for the good people and all the rest. And when we signed our names on that dotted line, we signed our names up and to include our life. We're willing to literally put our lives on the line to protect, you know, supposedly protect our families and our freedoms and all the rest. And so I think when people realize, veterans realize, that that was all bullshit and that we're actually fighting for corporations and banks and geopolitical strategic interests of state apparatuses and all the rest, I think that when that trust is broken and when they realize that they've been had and when they were willing, when we were willing to put our lives on the line, and then to learn that that was all for a bunch of nonsense, and in fact, not just nonsense or BS, but for the profit of corporations and the most nefarious people in the world, and then the death and destruction it caused, and our friends who were killed, and the people we had to kill as a result. When that is broken, I've seen a lot of veterans flip politically very quickly and immediately become not just radicalized, but also very willing to do a lot of work. There's a flip side to that as well, and I should throw that in there just from experience of working with veterans and also from my personal experience. Those of us, I think, who have been extremely traumatized, and I would say there's even a division between, say, infantry veterans and non-infantry veterans, or combat veterans and not, I should say, combat veterans and non-combat veterans, because there's a lot of non-infantry roles today that are sort of combat roles, like a motor T driver driving convoys of infantry soldiers is definitely a combat vet. So those veterans particularly that I've met, including myself, you know, there's been times when I've had to take extended breaks, you know, several months away from activism because, you know, my PTSD will reach incredible levels, or start thinking about killing myself on a regular basis. Like, if I start going through those periods, and then I know, you know, hey, it's time to take a little bit of a break here. And I think it's that intensity, like that experience and all of that trauma and all that nonsense that gave me, it sort of filled up my gas tank. And sometimes I feel like that fuel can be unhealthy, that sometimes, you know, that running on anger as much as, and I agree with you, a lot of it is love. You know, I love the people that I love. I love the living world. I'm tired of seeing vulnerable people being destroyed. I'm tired of seeing the planet being destroyed. And it does, because I love those things, give me a tremendous amount of anger, which then gives me a tremendous amount of energy to do things, I think, over the years, and has fueled a lot of what I've done. And, you know, once you see the kinds of things I think you see in combat, once you get to the activist world, and this is can be at times unhealthy, but, you know, once you get to the activist world, you're like, all right, you know, whatever they're going to do to us. I mean, I remember when we were going down to Ferguson, Missouri, and, you know, I was with some younger activists, and they, I could tell they were a little concerned, you know, and probably looking to me for some level of not leadership, because really a lot of the folks I was with are leaders in their own right, really great folks. But I think just kind of looking to me for a sense of like, is this situation okay? Should we get out of here? What's happening? And, you know, I thought to myself, I think personally, and I say this in as much of a, you know, non-hyperbolic way as possible, I mean, I'm willing to put my life on the line for the movement. And, you know, it's funny that we're having this conversation today, because I'm thinking about a movie series that I'm going to start doing here at Park, a documentary film series on the first Fridays of every month. And the first film I was going to show is going to be COINTELPRO 101. And there was a woman in the film, and I forget what her name was, but she was with the Mississippi Democratic Freedom Party, which was one of the few sort of independent electoral movements that was really worth a shit here in the United States. And she was saying at a rally, she was like a regular like county fair or something like this, and she was like, you know, you've got to be willing to die for these rights. And I thought to myself, when I've said that at rallies recently, I've had to give like an introduction to that, because I don't want people to think I'm crazy. And so I think to myself, how wild is it that then the context was severe and critical for many people and it was time to act, but now the situation is objectively more critical, especially ecologically speaking, some would also say with nuclear war, all the rest. And yet we're not having the conversations that people were having 50, 100, 150 years ago, where it was just like run of the mill. What do they say? Like par for the course, like for someone to get at the mic and say, look, you got to be willing to put your life on the line for this. Now, is that going to be everybody? I don't think so. Do we expect everybody to do that? No. But we definitely, and am I recommending that people go out and sort of like martyr themselves or anything like this? No. But what I am saying is that we at least have to have a serious conversation about what kind of sacrifice is it going to take to deal with the kind of crises that we face, and the disconnect between what we face and the kinds of conversations we're having about what people are willing to do is very profound. At least in my thinking. So I'm sorry for rambling. Maybe it's
no. It's perfect. No. What you're saying is great. And a couple things. One of them is that you said there are different roles, and some people need to put their lives on the line, and some people, if it's not appropriate, then you don't. And that's even true in a regular, honest to goodness military. I mean, as you said earlier, there are the combat veterans, and what is the percentage of people in a war who actually ever fire weapons in combat? It's very low.
It is low. I want to say it's like 5 or 10%.
Yeah.
It might be a little more than that. I think in the Marine Corps, it's different because a bigger part of the Marine Corps is the infantry than at least disproportionately. So for us, it might be a quarter of the Marine Corps, but in the services in general, I would say maybe 5-10%.
And the point being that no matter whether you're an activist or you're in the U.S. military or the Danish military, for that matter, most of the people are doing support work,
right?
And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's classic that we can probably both quote any number of generals through history who, you know, Napoleon, that the army moves on its stomach, and Rommel says that battles are won and lost by the quartermasters. You know, because basically
Von
without
Clausewitz,
oil, the tanks
all
are
these
useless.
Guys.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, Von Clausewitz, all these types.
So anyway, yeah, support's very important too. And another thing I wanted to say is that, and you can take this anywhere you want, you sort of brought this up. Recently, I was communicating with Chris Hedges, and he was going to write a certain essay. It doesn't matter what it was about. And I responded to him saying, gosh, you know, when this essay comes out, you're going to get a lot of death threats and a lot of, you know, threats to your livelihood and everything else. And he responded to me that, well, yes, and having been in Serbia and having had snipers shoot at you with armor-piercing bullets changes your perspective on that.
Yeah, yes, it does. Yeah, people's eyes. For instance, the other day I was we were talking about social media with our local group here, and we were just kind of joking afterward, and I was sort of conveying some of the messages and emails I've received over the years, and several people sort of just looked at me with these wide open eyes, and I was like, look, like it's not, you know, I laughed it off, but then I when I went home that night, I started to think that. You know, in I think in decent society, if there is such a thing, or if there's such an ideal, I guess, I don't know. I mean, for at least, you know, how can we like live with each other in this way that's not violent or threatening? I mean, I would, yeah, that is a big deal for people to send you death threats. But I mean, I've received that stuff since the day I testified to Congress and even before then, and that was years ago. So it's been a decade. 10, 11 years of people sending me the most horrendous things you can imagine via Facebook and email. And 99.9% of the time I laugh it off. The other 0.01% of the time, I actually kind of feel bad. I just kind of, I sit there and I guess I'm a sucker. Or I guess I'm just, I mean, like, I think sometimes, you know, I let my heart take over and, you know, 0.01% of the time, I guess I go, you know, geez, these are people, and like, what are, like, how sick do you have to be sending people like who aren't in any kind of position of power? I mean, if you want to send that message to Donald Trump, be my guest. If you want to send that message to General whoever, be my guest, or the CEO of ExxonMobil, but to send it to just some person who's like, look, you're trying to do positive things. I might not agree with those things. I mean, there's even, I have conservative people that I know who work at soup kitchens, who volunteer at homeless shelters, who do things that I think are commendable things. But I mean, we don't threaten each other's lives. I mean, it's just so in any case, I totally agree with Hedges. And it's the same even for the police. I mean, Vietnam veteran friend of mine used to say, you know, he was like, hey, you know, back in the day, we would say, what's the worst you're going to do to me? Shave my head and send me back to Vietnam. And so Sergio and I would often joke in the same way. And other veterans we know, you know, we'd be like, okay, what's the worst you're going to do to us? Like shave our heads and send us back to the war zone? Like anything less than that is going to be a step up from what we've experienced. So, I mean, you can throw me behind bars. You could torture me. You could do all that shit. You could do whatever you want. But I'm not going to have to go kill innocent people for no good reason. And I think anything is like, is better than that. And at this point, you know, I wonder, I guess the question I have is how long before either the government feels threatened enough because of the context in which we live, or the movements or a movement or several movements become potent enough to actually elicit a response from the government. And, you know, I wonder, man, I mean, we talk about these things. I read them in articles and all this, but I mean, I think it's probably the same for you, but there are plenty of times when I sit there at night by myself and, or with some friends, and I'm thinking, or we're thinking and talking, hey, how long before what we're doing becomes illegal, becomes very threatening, becomes, I mean, and there's people who are already being thrown behind bars. We know about the political prisoners and so forth, but on a larger scale, and in a more invasive manner, I just wonder how long is it going to take for the government to really clamp down on people and movements and so forth. And you know, what kind of relationships and bonds and trust do you need to build with people in order to be able to trust each other? I mean, I know you and I have talked about this privately, but you think of organizations like the mafia. I mean, these are organizations where it's well known, like, hey, Derek, if you rat me out, I will kill your family. I'm going to make your life a living hell. Then we're probably going to kill you. And even then, some of these guys end up ratting. And in fact, a lot of them did after they passed the RICO Act and all the rest. And then with the drug charges and, you know, going to jail for somebody for 5 or 10 years is one thing. Going to jail for somebody for 20 to 30 to life, I think, is a totally different thing. And, you know, what kind of movements, what kind of smart, sophisticated movements do you have to build, and what kind of bonds on an individual and a collective level do you have to build with people in order to make sure that you can mitigate those things from happening within the context of activism? That, you know, those for me are sort of the major questions that I think we don't. On the left, I think, approach in a way that we should, you know. So I'm thinking of big conferences like the People Summit in Chicago. Probably a lot of good things there. I know there were. I mean, I know a lot of people who went, but I'm thinking of these, and a lot of it is sort of just repeating things that people already is already acceptable on the left, you know, which bothers me, because I think for me, one of the best things about being a human being, one of the best things about being alive, at least in this body, is just, you know, you challenge yourself. Mentally, emotionally, spiritually, physically, like, you really want to, I think, always kind of take yourself and be like, hey, what's the next level here? What is challenging? What can surprise me? You know, what gives me a good challenge? I think those things are good. And politically, I think that's something we shy away from sometimes on the left. And we just, you're obviously not guilty of this. But other people, I think, are. And even I think I have been myself, where I'll repeat things, or I'll just simply say things, and I'm like, well, this is more acceptable than saying this. And so then it's like, all right, what is this wager that I'm making with myself? Like, am I trying to reach out to as many people as possible? Am I just trying to reach out to the people that we're working with? Those kinds of questions, I guess, are things that are constantly in my mind. And how many compromises do you have to make? How much should one compromise in these contexts? And how can we develop, you know, movements and organizations and institutions that are disciplined enough, which brings us to either martial arts or military training, which I think is a great benefit for military training as well, disciplined enough and smart enough and savvy enough to be effective, to win. And, you know, I think speaking in those terms and asking those questions is something that I would personally like to see more on the left. I think if we are going to be serious about stopping the destruction of the planet and stopping the U.S. empire, stopping global capitalism, whatever it is people are trying to stop who are radical activists.
Well, I love all the things you're saying, which is, and all these questions you're asking are some of the reasons I just adore you. So I want to go more with this. I want to go with the discipline angle in a second, but I also want to respond to a few of the things you said as you were going through there.
Yeah, please.
One of them is that you said you wonder when the United States will start really ratcheting up the oppression. And, you know, you and I are both aware that the oppression's already ongoing. We're not saying it's not happening, but when it will become sort of a Gestapo style, or when it will ratchet up. And I've always been informed by that, by something that John Stockwell said. He was a CIA agent who came out against the agency. And at one of his talks I heard on tape, he said, somebody asked him, you know, if all the things you're saying about how horrible the CIA is if they're all true, why haven't they killed you? And his answer was very short, and it was because they're winning.
Right.
And so what's really clear to me, at least, is that so long as they're winning, we can have our conferences, we can do all this stuff, and for the most part, it's not going to matter. And then one of the things that gives me courage is that at this point, for the most part, they're not going to do much against most of us because they're winning. And the thing is, when it kicks over, being nice won't have protected you. That when it does ratchet up, then anybody associated with anybody is going to be in trouble.
Yeah, and the history, that thinking of that COINTELPRO film and thinking about the history of COINTELPRO, that's very clear. Even the activists who were completely nonviolent, peaceful people who even worked with city and state and government, federal government officials were framed, put in jail or assaulted, murdered, and all the rest. And so what I think, though, Derek, is also like a situation, for instance, which I think would be one of the most catastrophic situations for both the left and also just for the world in general. But what would be like a severe terrorist attack in the United States. So for me, that means a college football game on a Saturday, you know, that means a Cubs game on a July Sunday or something like this. If a bomb goes off in a place like that and it's on camera and you see kids and all the rest, the worry that I have is that much like September 11th, like I feel like the government was winning at the end of the 90s and in the early 2000s. So there's no, I guess, rational reason for them to clamp down even further. But here I think of just, you know, thinking of the way that institutions function. And I think Chomsky was one of the first to mention this after 9/11, but that was basically every state apparatus in the world was going to use 9/11 as an opportunity to clamp down on their people. And I often wonder, even before, say, ecological catastrophes, cataclysmic things happen here for people. I wonder, like, what kind of political and economic, like another recession, a terrorist attack, and I wonder, like, where that would leave movements and how that would leave people exposed and if they would start coming after people just for the hell of it because they would have the pretext to do so. So anyway, that's kind of what I had in my mind when I was thinking of that as well.
And we don't need to get into this. It's not only the government. It's also non-governmental entities, by which I don't just mean corporate goons either. I also mean mobs.
Right. Right-wing militias too.
This is what happens at the end of empire. Mm-hmm. And another thing I wanted to mention is you asked who we can trust. And, you know, I used to teach at maximum security prison. And I would ask some of my students, especially the ones who were not the ones who were in for, like, there was a guy who murdered his parents. That's not what we're talking about. But there were some of them who were in, for example, for smuggling drugs across the border from Mexico to the United States. And so I asked them that question. It's like, how did you know whom to trust, you know, when you're doing this? And in their case, it was actually really easy because they said, the people I worked with, I grew up with as friends in my little village in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this person was as close as my brother and was not going to turn me in. So in their case, it was really easy. And the reason I bring all this up is because something that you just hammer all the time is the importance of community. And they had that. So that question was really easy for them. But for most of us in this atomized world, that question becomes really paramount.
Right. Right. No, and you know, I'm thinking of, I don't know if you've read the book, and I don't know if there's much merit to it, but I've heard a lot about Sebastian Younger's new book called Tribe, and he's talking a lot, I guess, about how human beings function in these groups of like 40 to 50 people, and how human beings throughout times have functioned under great stress in those types of groups, and why veterans who operate in platoons, which is usually about 40 to 50 people, come back yearning for that camaraderie that you can only experience in those high stress situations. So I in this context with laws and jails and so forth, I worry because of the atomized nature of society. But what I do think is that in, say, these institutions start to collapse and people do start to band together as tribes or as smaller communities, I can imagine the levels of trust and cooperation going through the roof. And I think this is why people still yearn for their military experience and even more particularly their combat experience, because the levels of trust that you have to have with people are so much deeper and so much more meaningful than, you know, your day-to-day interactions, going to the grocery store, filling up your car with gas, you know, going to get a bite to eat, going to watch a movie, whatever it is that you're into, passing by someone at the local park. You know, it when you get back from that kind of a situation, everything seems quite superficial and petty. And oftentimes, of course, this is why people fall into drugs and alcohol and all the rest, violent behavior. But it's also another reason why people, I think, like myself and others, look for those smaller tribes again, where you're looking for people who are willing to fight for something that is worth dying for, that is worth putting your time and your resources and your life on the line for. And then hopefully through that process, much like war, but in a different context, at least for now, you do build up that trust with people. You know, I mean, there's people I've been doing activist work for many, many years who, you know, when those, if those relationships are broken, I'm sure you've had that as well. It feels like you've lost a loved one. You know, I've been friends with people in the activist world, and then, you know, after 10 years of work, something happens, disagreement, different relationships, whatever happens, you know, politically or something. And because of the trust that you build up with someone doing that work, it really does feel like you've lost a brother or a sister. So at least that's been my experience. Is it the same for you?
Yes. Yes, it has been.
Okay.
And a book idea occurred to me that I can either put in my list, or you can put in your list to write, or some listener can. But I think it'd be pretty interesting to see a book that examines resistance movements throughout history. And it doesn't matter who they are. It could be the IRA, it could be the German resistance against Hitler, it could be the Russian resistance against Hitler, doesn't matter. And examine specifically the question of trust and trust building and betrayal. I mean, you talked earlier about the mafia and how, 40 years versus 10 years makes you a lot more likely to betray someone. And we can certainly say the same thing about the Gestapo. And, you know, when somebody is putting electrodes on your genitals, it becomes right. much easier to betray your comrades. Right. Anyway, so just the question of I think it'd be really interesting to see an examination of how different organizations, especially underground organizations, have dealt with the question of trust throughout history.
Yeah, some kind of a comparative analysis, like who and then who did it better and why. I think exactly. It just would be
Is how then we can use it to build right. trust ourselves.
Right. No, and I figured that's where you're going with, but I just wanted to throw that out there for the listeners, because I still running into folks who are like have these ideas, but I'm always like, okay, cool, and. Like, yeah. like so,
exactly.
And so how do I use this to stop what's happening?
So before we talk about discipline, I want to tell listeners about my first meeting with you, and you and Sergio picked me up at an event in Michigan to drive me to the event in Indiana, and. You know, I've had people pick me up everywhere, and people have treated me very well. This is not – that's not in question. I'm not saying people have treated me poorly, but there was – it's like I'm there, and then immediately – I think it was Sergio picks up my suitcase, and you open the door for me, and there was a certain – and it's not the deference that I'm talking about. It's the – there was a disciplined courtesy. I've had other people carry my suitcase before. That's not a big deal. But there was a disciplined courtesy that struck me in one moment and impressed the hell out of me too, by the way. And I was talking to, I think, probably my mom about it a couple days later. And she's like, yeah, they were in the military. And so I want to use that as a segue to talk about, and I know that's a trivial example, but
no, it's actually really important. So we had a friend who was in town recently, and I don't want to get too much into all personal stuff, but what I do want to say is that Sergio and I will often say things to him about just his simple day-to-day interactions. And those day-to-day interactions, for instance, when we're at a diner, and a server walks up and, you know, to make eye contact and not to just keep eating if they drop something off at the table without acknowledging their presence, making sure that you do hold doors for people, making sure that you are courteous with people. Like, those things for me on a smaller level operate as a form of discipline that then should carry over into other forms. So let's bring this back to military training. So they don't discipline you. So let's put it this way. You don't go into boot camp on day one or week one and start patrolling with a weapon in your hand. In fact, as an infantry soldier or a Marine, you're not, as an infantry Marine, and I'll speak just to my personal experience, you don't really do that until 16 weeks of training. Actually sit in a formation with a group of people with weapons, let alone live ammunition, which might only happen once over the course of 24 weeks of training. So what do they start you with first? Can you stand up straight? Can you, and I don't mean to sound ableist when I say some of these things, so I just want to throw that out there. But, you know, can you stand there on the line? Can you keep a straight face? Can you keep your hands and your knuckles at your seam of your pants? You know, can you fold your socks properly and fold your rack properly? You know, can you make your bed, or what we call the rack? You know, can you fold your socks? Can you have everything in line? Can you have your footlocker organized? Can you follow simple commands like yes, sir, after certain commands, or kill after other commands? Will you move to the right or to the left when given a command to do so? Now, that is an extreme example, and it's obviously in a very destructive institution, particularly here in the United States. But I think that you could take a lot of those lessons and the fundamentals, which for me mean starting off very small with people. So if you can't be disciplined enough to get up and at least make your bed, at least, you know, maybe get something healthy to eat if you can afford it, if you have access to it, like making little schedules for yourself, making sure that you are living up to your commitments, and just doing the smaller things that then I think, you know, after weeks and weeks and weeks of training, then finally, as I was explaining to my neighbor who didn't know this the other day, you know, in Marine Corps boot camp, you don't shoot a weapon until I think week 11 of a 13-week boot camp. So you're training and learning discipline for 11 weeks before the United States Marine Corps even gives you a weapon to fire. So when I think of resistance movements, when I think of even, say, nonviolent direct action groups who are performing very illegal actions, but say in a nonviolent fashion, but who still face serious repercussions, I think to myself, we need activists and organizations who are disciplined on the same level. And maybe not in the same manner, obviously, but I do think some of those techniques and some of the long view that, you know, we're not going to just discipline people in the course of a weekend workshop, or we're not just going to discipline people even if you could spend a week with someone. I mean, we're talking about having people for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 16 weeks before you can trust them enough, and that's under great duress and stress for those 16 weeks, just to get people to the point where they can walk down a street together and know what to do if someone fires on them. And I don't want to like overly stress that. I don't want to like people who are thinking out there, geez, I just want my group to be a little more disciplined, you know, or I just want to find some discipline for myself to do that. That's the ideal, I would say. And I would say that that's a model, but you know, in any small way. And I think that that extends to day-to-day courtesies, to looking at someone when they're talking to you, to listening someone who's talking to you, to be there in the moment, to, you know, to pay attention to what you're doing and what you're saying, and, you know, the way that you're coming across to people. I mean, I think that's a very important thing. And I think that, you know, just starting with those small things, like, you know, hell, can I do a half hour of working out today? I don't really like to read, but I know that reading is very good for me. I know my brain is a muscle. I need to work it. Can I at least read for a half hour, 45 minutes a day? Just those little things, I think, if you stay with them long enough, and if you do them, I think they'll have a profound impact on your life. I think there's no question about that.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was done.
I think this is incredibly important. I think the importance of this cannot be go ahead.
I was going to say, so the other day I saw this clip from Oliver Stone, and it was a really good clip and whatever about his movies, and I don't know him as a person, so if he's an asshole as a person, I apologize. I'm just with what he said the other day at some, it was the National Writers Guild Awards, and the gist of what he said, there was like towards the end, he was like, look, I've been fighting these people, and I'm paraphrasing, but he was like, look, I've been fighting these people who make war my entire life, and most of the time you're going to get your ass kicked. He's like, you're going to get insulted. There's people who are going to make threats against you, and there's going to even be people who flatter you. But at the end of the day, if you can stay the course, and if you believe in what you're saying, then you can make a difference. And there's been a lot of people, Derek, over the years. Sergio and I talk about this pretty regularly. I would say 90 to 95% of the people that I started doing activist work with no longer do the kind of activist work that Sergio and I are still engaged with. They might be involved on a smaller level, which is still good. They might be doing artistic work, which is all good. All that stuff's good, you know, but in terms of on being at that same level we were at 22, thinking we want to radically change society and we're not going to deviate from these principles, there's very few of us who've remained. Now, some of that is the toxicity of the left. Some of that is life can beat you down. Some of that is we're living in one of the most fucked up economic periods in U.S. history and all this other stuff. I mean, all that's true. But another large part of that is, and this is from seeing people, at least anecdotally, and I would like to see a study on this, but just how many people sort of fell away because they couldn't maintain some level of discipline that, like, no, like, I have it in my head that this is what I'm doing for the rest of my life. Like, that this isn't, I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. I'm not just saying that at the pub because we're having a few beers. I'm not just saying that to make you happy. I'm not just saying that because that's what I think I want to hear. But I have seriously sat back and meditated and thought to myself, okay, maybe meditation is the wrong word because I'm not really into some of those things. I am. That's a different story. Nonetheless, sat there and reflected and thought to yourself, is this what I'm seriously all about and why? Because it better not be for, you know, whatever, a career or book deals or to get your name in the newspaper or to appear on radio programs. If it's for those reasons, you're in the wrong fucking line of business and I don't want to be around you. And number two, you're going to fall away anyway because this work, as most people know who do it, is very difficult. It is time consuming. And it is extremely stressful and it can beat you down. It is on the flip side, very rewarding. You meet amazing people. You get to participate in very meaningful activities. You don't have to look back, as many of my friends are doing in their early 30s, and asking, God, what the hell did I do with my 20s? And God, what the hell did I do for the last decade? I haven't asked that question. I mean, are there things I would have done better? I mean, of course, I'm not crazy. I mean, there's plenty of things. I mean, that's, for me, part of being disciplined is, you know, it's not that you're going to always be this perfect person. It's that you're going to notice when you start screwing up. It's like, you know I need to get back into shape right now. I know that that's the case. I'm not in the kind of shape I need to be in. So what's that going to require? That's going to require me clamping down sort of on myself. So, you know, I just think little things like that is like, and even showing up to stuff that sometimes you don't want to, you know, for the activists who are out there and so on, you know, and I have to be reminded of this when I watch those old video clips and I see someone, and I need to find her name, like the woman from the Mississippi Freedom Party, who was telling people at a, like, just regular rally, folks dressed like they're going to church, you're going to have to put your lives on the line. I mean, that kind of stuff, it's not like that kind of stuff reminds me, that kind of stuff inspires me. You know, the other day when I saw clips of disabled people who are terminally ill being dragged out of senators' offices just because they need their Medicaid and their health care, that stuff not only enrages me, those images and those kinds of actions inspire me. I mean, how can you not be the least bit inspired? How can I look at someone who's terminally ill in a goddamn wheelchair, and I'm sitting there at home going, man, I really don't know if I want to go to this meeting tonight, like, or I really don't know if I want to go to this action next week or whatever. It's like, no, like, okay, sometimes you got to take your break so you don't burn out. But a lot of times I think we make a lot of excuses for people, and I actually think it's insulting. It's not like, we understand these are systemic issues, but I've had people tell me, well, you know, they're poor immigrants. Like, we can't expect them to stand up. And I'm like, do you understand how patronizing that is? Like, do you understand how offensive that is? Like there's not tons of immigrant families who are already standing up. Like, how about we highlight their work? How about we use them as an example and not, you know, sit back and with this, I don't even know, like, goofy mentality go, oh, well, you know, we can't expect them to stand up like they're in this position. It's like, no, that's we can never. I don't think we should ever do that. I don't think that's what good organizers are. I don't think that's what good leaders, intellectual, cultural, political leaders do. I think they say, hey, I understand your situation. Maybe I'm even in your situation. But regardless, I'm here to walk with you, to work with you hand in hand. And this is what we're going to do. I'm not going to say, hey, well, you know, it's a bad systemic problem and I don't really expect you to do much about it because you're in this terrible state. I mean, I think of other situations. I think if you can resist slavery, I mean, abolitionists, I mean, oh, I just think of the, I think those things fire me up because I think, man, if these people could do what they did under those circumstances, then damn it. Like I can't make excuses for myself. And I can't run away and I can't make excuses for other people. I just, you know, if people need to take breaks, like I said, I understand that. But at the end of the day, we need to be holding those people up as examples. We don't need to be sitting back and saying, well, you know, Derek, he has health problems. So, you know, I don't expect him really to write that much or I don't expect him to do anything. I mean, yeah, I mean, a lot of us have health problems and to varying degrees, we can all put in what we could put in. But I do think all of us, including myself, need people other than just ourselves to push us. And that's why I love people like Sergio or my dad or my mom or other people who are like, hey, Vince, you know, you could be doing a little more. Or, hey, you know, you could help this out more. Or, you can. That's the kind of that to me is real friendship. It's not just sitting there going, oh, Derek, you know, you're the greatest person in the world and you don't do anything wrong. I mean, it's like, hey, if we spend enough time around each other where we're comfortable enough to have those conversations, that's what good activism is. That's what good organizing is. I mean, building trust, I think, also includes critiques. And as long as they're done with solidarity in mind and with, you know, good intentions, I think that's what it's all about. I mean, we should always be critiquing and, you know, improving as much as we can, because obviously we're not winning with what we're doing now.
Well, we have about, oh gosh, 5 or 6 minutes left. And we just have to save self-defense for another time.
Okay.
And, I mean, there's.
I'm sorry. I've been. I'm
no, no, no. This is perfect. This is great. This is wonderful. And the another thing that you brought up that I also want to just say, but I want to save for another time because I know you're going to have a lot of great things to say about it, is something else that's very clear in the military, at least from reading military history, which is all I've ever done, is that it's very clear that if there's a war, you want to win. And the other day, so I'm reading a book right now. Well, okay, I'm going to back up. I'm just going to ramble for a couple minutes.
Yeah.
One thing is having to do with the discipline. One reason I have so many books out is, surprisingly enough, because I write. And, you know, that's it. You know, it's a cliche, but my mother's grandmother used to say all the time, inch by inch, life's a cinch. And so I don't write whole books. It's just like today, I have typed in edits I made on, today it was 40 some pages. And I did those edits over the previous 3 or 4 days of about 90 pages. And now I'm going to print those out. I'm going to read it again tonight. And then tomorrow I will type in those changes. And then I'm done with that 90 pages. I mean, obviously it had to be written in the first place. But the point is, I do work every day. And another thing I want to say about that has to do with the whole reading thing, is one of the smartest things I did when I was a teenager is I decided that every night before I went to bed, I would read 10 pages of a book that was good for me that I would never get through otherwise. Hmm. And it's pretty extraordinary that if you do 10 pages every night, which is a piece of cake, then in a year you've got 3,600 pages. And that's a bunch of books. So I've read Oswald Spengler that way. The first one I ever read was Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And then when I was like 20, I read all of Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And it's not a big deal. It was just 10 pages a night, slow but sure. And why am I bringing all this up? Oh, the reason I'm bringing all this up is because right now I'm reading a book called Thunder on the Dnieper, which is about the Russian defense against Operation Barbarossa when the Germans invaded in World War II. And there was a question asked early on. I'm just going to say this now. We don't have time to deal with it, but I want to ask you this question for an entire interview sometime in the future. And the early on in the book, they're saying a military maxim is don't do what your enemy expects. And I read that, and I don't really 100% agree with that, because if you have a really defensible position and your enemy expects you to defend it, you may as well, if it's really defensible, if it's the best place. Instead, the question I'm interested in is, what does your enemy most fear? And then do that. And I asked this on Facebook. I asked just people in general, and it was so interesting because the responses by many of the people were things like building an alternative currency, not spending money. And there was one person said, destroy the transportation infrastructure that allows the movement of resources. And I clicked on the guy, and he's ex-military.
Yeah, it's not surprising.
Yeah. So at some point, and I realize this is the total crap thing to do in this interview, and we have like 1 minute left, I would like for you, if you don't mind, to think about that question. If you were in power, what would you most fear? And then I would love to interview you again in the future on that question.
Right on. I would love to do it.
Okay, so far as settling down today, we can't really talk about self-defense because we only have like 2 minutes.
Well, here's the best quote, please. I can give you that would, I think, encompass everything that we're doing. And it's a good old jiu-jitsu quote that is attributable to no one. No one knows where it came from. And the quote is very simple. It is, or the saying is very simple. It's simply, a black belt is a white belt that never stopped coming to practice. And that's all a black belt is in jiu-jitsu. Every single day, or as many times as you can go, there's people who get it in 8 years. There's people who get it in 25 years. But the point is to just get up and do it and do as much as you can and show up when you can and try and make that a regular habit. And to me, that falls into everything from creating community to building trust to becoming more disciplined to learning more about politics to becoming a better organizer to being a more disciplined writer. It's, as you said, you got to get up and do it. And that's the old saying, you know, it's just a white belt who never gave up.
Well, that's so great. And thank you so much. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Vince Emanuele. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.